I'm David Schreiner Kahn, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Ted Koyne. Ted is the Chief Marketing Officer of MetalIt, an enterprise SaaS firm at the cutting edge of content marketing through employee advocacy. Ted is also a Forbes Top 20 Social Media Power Influencer and an Inc. Top 100 Leadership Expert. He is the co-author of A World Gone Social, How Companies Must Adapt to Survive. Ted is an Inc. Top 100 speaker and one of Business News Daily's 15 Twitter accounts every entrepreneur should follow. Ted is also a serial business founder and three-time CEO. He lives in Naples, Florida with his wife and two daughters. Ted, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on today.
David, thank you so much. I'm really excited to speak with you and hopefully help your audience a little bit.
Thank you. I wondered if we could start off by you describing a little bit about why you do what you do.
Sure. Right, exactly, because my resume kind of looks like somebody threw a grenade into a normal career.
I don't think there is a normal career.
And I think people have learned to come to that realization themselves. You've got to reinvent yourself. So why do I do what I do? First of all, I'm just insatiably curious, and especially about people. That's why I love business so much. It's really business's psychology. And so I just love learning, and pursuing topics of interest to me end up years down the road turning into a book or a new business or whatever. So that's why I do what I do. About 6 years ago now, I began the, you know, basic research for what finally became A World Gone Social, which came out in September of 2014. And part of the research, I was learning, you know, boy, the business environment is so different, so exciting. What an opportunity for startups. And when I found Metal, I got to apply a lot of the things that I'd been learning to help this startup grow. And, you know, I'm really, really passionate about individual, you know, personal branding. That's, you know, part of our book, and that's what Metal does. It helps businesses grow by leveraging their pride in their individuals with all that knowledge, all the smarts, kind of flips marketing on its head. And I absolutely love that.
So what's different about the way the way business operates today, and why you have reached this point where you're focusing on content marketing through employee advocacy?
The industrial age was roughly 100-150 years of oddity, where before it, you know, we had agricultural economies forever. That was, you know, from the dawn of civilization. People mostly worked independently or in small groups, and, you know, on farms for the most part. And then the industrial age came along and changed everything and brought most of us into the factory and most of us into cities. And cities are great, but factories have been, you know, completely redesigned, and they're a minor part. Manufacture is a minor part of what happens today. What most of us do for a living, we may be in the service sector, or more likely, we are thought leaders. We are using our brains, and often in small groups. This environment that we're in today, beginning about 2008, the industrial age finally ended. So a nice kind of line of demarcation, it's just symbolic, but I really like it, is the day Lehman Brothers collapsed. It was September 17th. Lehman Brothers stopped, and that was really kind of a beginning of our slide into the Great Recession. You could argue it started happening before that, but it's a really good symbol. And that's also a symbol of when the industrial age breathed its last gasp And now we're in the social age. What the social age means is that enough people in 2008 got on social media talking to each other that companies lost all control of spin. They lost it in talking to their customers. They lost it talking to recruits. They lost it talking to their own employees, regulators, the community, every single thing. Companies are no longer in control as they were in the industrial age. It's an entirely new age of business. And the idea that companies kind of can keep their employees sequestered and just have a marketing department or a PR department that's very small with a targeted, very scripted message, good luck. And it's also, nobody trusts it. I'm a marketer. Nobody trusts marketers. I don't trust marketers. Let's face it. A marketer's job is to sell you something you may or may not need. They've got to sell it to you anyway. And we all know that because we're all customers. We are B2B customers if we're in a business leadership position. And we're certainly consumer customers every single day. And we don't trust advertising. We don't trust, you know, the canned messages. Who reads a corporate blog, for instance? You know, about 60% of the companies out there still rely for the number one message on a corporate blog, which is the most biased thing in the world. So that's why nobody reads it, because you know if you go to company, you know, if you go to Acme's blog, Acme's going to tell you how wonderful Acme is. Well, you know what? I'd much rather go, you know, if Acme's a tech company, I'd much rather go to TechCrunch or, you know, Wired or someplace else to get the real scoop from an unbiased professional. We trust individuals. We trust third-party outsiders. We trust customers. We trust employees. We do not trust canned marketing messages anymore.
Talk to me about the trusting employees part, because that's one that I don't hear a lot about.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. And this actually, so I began working with Metal in December, and I met their CEO, and he started telling me some things, how the company, how they formed the company, where the idea came from. He was working with Ogilvy. This is Vidar Brekke. He was working with Ogilvy as the brand, I forget, but anyway, representing IBM. And he was working with them. And what he learned from this group of IBM that he was working with is that when the employees shared things, people were 700% more likely to buy from them or even read the stuff that they were sharing than when the marketing department did. So, and you know, you look at studies, people trust CEOs very little, which is why a CEO needs to get on social and have conversations with others. The trust goes way up. They trust marketing just a little bit more, and they trust employees plenty, which is nice. You know, it's pretty easy to see when somebody's shilling for their company and when somebody's just you know, conversing with you online because they've got interests and they're happy to talk about those interests. It's really obvious to see when they're trying to make the marketing department happy. So we trust individual people so much more than canned marketing messages. It's a really refreshing look at, well, okay, you know, a company has all these employees. You know, if you look at an enterprise, maybe they have 50,000 employees or 500,000 employees. Those employees are not just this silent mass. They're people with thoughts, with expertise in their given field. And if a company can take advantage of that, rather than, you know, saying, hey, here's some stuff we want you to share to your social networks, if they can say, we want to help you share your message with your followers and your connections and your friends on the various networks, that's a really, really different way of looking at marketing.
So as the CEO in a company where I realize that my employees are my best ambassadors, mm-hmm. what should I start doing differently? What kind of mind shift do I need to make in order to leverage the value that my employees can bring in marketing?
Here's the thing. Your employees are your best ambassadors if they like your company. And that has everything to do with old-fashioned how do you treat them. If 70% of employees, and this has been going on for at least, 10 years. I forget when Gallup first started doing engagement surveys of employees, how they feel about their company. 70% in the United States and much worse overseas just don't like working where they work. And that's a huge problem. So what my number one advice to business leaders, as a business leader myself, is your job one is to make your company a best place to work. And if you're a very large company, make it a best place to work on, Fortune's 100 best places to work list. If you're a small company, there are lists for each state, for instance. For smaller companies, listed by state. And these are imperfect lists, but just, drive for it. I can't tell you the difference when you start working with a company that treats its employees well and a company that just doesn't. You can walk into the front door of the company and before you even speak with anybody at security, you've already caught a vibe. You can tell whether people are just engaged with their work. And if they're not engaged with their work, first of all, you're going to lose them, which is terrible. Second of all, they're not giving you their all right now on the job, which is, again, terrible. It's bad for your bottom line. And third of all, good luck getting them to represent you. They're just either not going to do it or they're going to do it half-heartedly.
So the primary thing is to create a winning culture.
Exactly. Exactly. And that has nothing to do with social media.
Have you seen some examples of companies that have suddenly caught on to this idea and have shifted the internal messaging and shifted how the leadership behaves with respect to employees?
Well, it's really funny. So I was just brought up that a fish stinks from the head. And also the flip side of that is that the leader is in charge of culture, the very top leader. So the chief executive, if it's a small company, the owner. If it's a large company, it can be the chairman of the board. The person at the very top of the company, do they respect their employees? And then, we all kind of surround ourselves with people who give us good information, which is nice, but they also filter information from us. The larger your company gets, the more filtering is going on. And so, of course, the people who are the most kind of celebrated and rewarded by a company are going to have a different view of the company than the people on the front lines and in the middle. So one thing that I really notice is just an incredible breath of fresh air is when you get new leadership and all of a sudden the new leader cares about the employees, where before maybe not so much. And they spend time, management by walking around, which Hewlett and Packard started doing and gave a name to in the 1930s, by the way. It's not a social age construct at all. Management by walking around, getting to know people, lock yourself out of your office for a day. So often when there's turnover at the top, it's either really good news or really bad news for changing the culture, shaking it up. And one example that I just love, I've actually become friends with this leader, and he has since retired, is Vineet Nayar of HCLT. So he was the CEO of this global company based in India. And during his tenure, he started the company was about, when he became CEO of the entire company, he was running a division before that. They were at $400 million. And when he left, they were at $800 million. And when he left, they were at $4 billion, just a few years later. And the way he did that was he said, employees first, customer second is going to be not just a nice thought, it's going to be an actual policy. And we're going to build it together. They made a whole bunch of mistakes along the way, but they kept progressing forward. And what he decided was, if we want our customers to be happy, we can't tell our people to make them happy. We have to show them how by making our employees happy. And we have to break down these silos and break down the barriers between the frontline employees and me, the CEO. So they use collaboration technology in order to do that. Right now, the nice thing about being a leader in this day and age is there's so many electronic communication tools available to you. They're really kind of commoditized, and you can connect with all of your employees with, you know, a few. They can reach out to you very easily. There's no need for gatekeepers any longer. So he's a great example. Then he wrote a book called Employees First, Customer Second. I read the book and reached out to him because I liked it so much. And that's how we became at least somewhat friends.
That's a great example. Do you think that the social age makes it easier or harder to be a CEO today?
Well, you know, it depends what your personality is like. If you're a command and control tyrant, it makes it much harder, just much harder. If you are someone who likes just, you know, taking the private elevator up to the penthouse and surrounding yourself with your direct reports all day long, and there are plenty of leaders like that today who fit that description, then it makes it really hard for you. If you are a person with an outgoing personality who just loves to connect with other people, then, you know, let's take one example. Take Richard Branson. Now, this guy is just, he's a billionaire. He has 50,000 people in his organization, roughly 500 different brands under the Virgin Group. And he just loves being out there in the limelight. He loves talking to people. And he did that before social ever started, before anybody had ever invented, quote, Web 2.0, or, you know, before MySpace was even a twinkle in somebody's eye, not to mention Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. And this guy has just gone social because he's like, wow, this is a great way for me to connect with even more people, more of my employees, and more of the public.
Look, humans have been social forever.
Exactly.
Right? It has nothing to do with the communication tools that we have now.
Yeah.
We're social beings.
Exactly. You know, that's the thing that really cracks me up when I talk to somebody and they say, oh, yeah, we've got somebody in charge of social media. What? Social media is not, first of all, it's not the headliner here. Social media is kind of like the catalyst. You've got all the ingredients, but they're not mixing properly. You add social media and boom, all of a sudden you've got a different mixture entirely because the catalyst of social media has gone in there and just transformed the way that everybody's communicating with everybody else. But we've been social beings forever. You know, it's really, really the constructs that we had in place during the industrial age were really unnatural. The command and control structure, the huge, lumbering, slow bureaucracies. That stuff, we humans don't like that very much. We don't like being a number. We don't like being, you know, somebody who just does our role and has a very small part to play in the world. We have big brains that we like to exercise in many different ways. We've got thoughts that we like to share with others. It used to be that we would do this around the, you know, the village well, or even around the campfire. And now we can do it via social.
It's fascinating. Ted, what were some of your experiences as a business founder and CEO? And how might your personal experiences tie into this whole notion of the social age?
I have made every mistake on the earth at least a couple times each and learned from them tremendously. So for instance, when I started my first business, it was in 2001. I was 34 years old. And it was a very, you know, kind of brick and mortar business. It was teaching English as a second language. And then we hired teachers and we taught other languages as well. We sent them to companies. But the experience that I had as a leader with my very first business was, you know, kind of I knew what needed to be done and I was too hands-on. And that was just a huge leadership mistake. You've got to pass that level. You know, the company will never grow bigger than its founder until its founder gets out of the way. So my second endeavor, I've spent 2 years working just as hard in nonprofits, and I learned how to lead volunteers. And the thing about volunteers is you can't bribe them. It isn't like, okay, if I give you 10,000 more a year, will you do this thing that you don't want to do? Because you're not paying them anything. And you can't, you know, threaten them with anything, because what are you going to do? You're not allowed to volunteer here anymore, you know, which would be the opposite, kind of like the corollary of you're fired. So figuring out how to get people to do what you want them to do by making it what they want to do also. First, you have to start before that. You have to say, okay, what do these volunteers that I've attracted want to do? Why did they choose volunteering for my organization in the first place? It's a whole different mindset from, you know, top-down leadership, from command and control leadership. A really, really valuable lesson. That's why one of the things that I tell leaders is, you know, if you want to develop your people, make volunteering, you know, leadership volunteering, a not just serving on a board, by the way. You go serve on a board, you talk to board members, and then you're done for the week or for the month or whatever. That's no. Lead volunteers in a hands-on, active, meaningful way and get something done with those volunteers. That is invaluable leadership experience.
And you have to engage volunteers. Otherwise, they won't volunteer.
So one of my most popular blog posts ever is that, you know, treat all your employees like, I forget the title, but anyway, treat all your employees like they're volunteers. And this is how I came up with this. I read an article, this is years ago, of this tech CEO who said, you know, I'm terrified that when our company is vested, when everybody's, you know, got the stocks that they've been working for, they will then leave. You know, let's say it's a 5-year vesting period, and so you work your tail off for a company for 5 years, then you own the stocks that you have been promised. And you know, he said, I'm terrified that we're about to hit that mark, and a whole bunch of our talented people are gonna leave. And you know what? Of course they are. It's got nothing to do with the stocks vesting. It's got to do with the fact that you weren't treating them well for the last 5 years.
Are employees more excited on a Monday morning than they are on a Friday afternoon?
I love that. Yeah. You know, this is just who I am. I say, thank God it's Monday. But here's the thing. Sometimes I'll start saying, thank God it's Monday. And maybe a couple years later, I'm like, oh boy, is it Friday yet? And that's when I know I've stayed too long at whatever gig, even if it's mine. Even if it's my own company that I founded, if I start saying that to myself, if I don't wake up on Monday morning and say, woohoo, I finally get to go back to work, then I know there's a problem. And your employees need to be saying that, and it can't be a joke. And if you have work, that's interesting. We humans actually, you know, this is something that people don't understand. People love to work. We've got these big brains, and if we don't keep them busy, they start to turn to jelly, and we hate that, and we're miserable. So, you know, I live down in Florida. There's more retirees here than, you know, anywhere on earth, probably. And I'll tell you again and again, I'll meet these successful business people come down here. They're, oh, great, I get to golf. And a week later, they're like, I can't golf anymore. That's how I met a lot of our volunteers, actually, is then they would look for nonprofit opportunities. They also look for, you know, business mentoring, you name it. Because being retired is not nearly as exciting as being on a vacation. You know, everybody needs a vacation. But me personally, after the first week, I'm kind of done with my vacation.
Well, people want to find meaning in their lives.
Exactly.
And since work is our primary focus for a good bit of our lives, Why shouldn't we want to find meaning in our work?
Exactly.
It's only natural.
Yeah, exactly. It's completely natural. And the thing is, you know, if you have work that just pays the bills, and, you know, we need that, we need to pay our bills. If you have that type of work, you will look for meaning outside of work. You know, that's how a lot of people start their businesses nights and weekends, because they have this excess need to work, to be creative, to have meaning in their lives that's not being fulfilled at work. And, you know, good for them, terrible for the business that's not engaging them.
Ted, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the critical shift points that companies reach when they've been successful, but then they hit a plateau. I know you mentioned this notion of needing, of the CEO needing to get out of his or her own way and enable other people to take the reins and to take some responsibility. What are some of the other examples that you've come across in your in your work?
Sure. So my entire life, from well before when I was 34 and started my own business, I've been just fascinated with leadership and speaking with leaders. My father brought me up to think in terms of, you know, what leadership is and how to be a better leader. It's just a lifelong fascination for me. And so speaking with leader after leader after leader over my entire career, and, you know, many of them, most of them business leaders, you do find these plateaus, and a lot of time it's because companies are just, you know, one of the biggest problems is when a company is small and entrepreneurial and growing, they're doing that, it's exciting, and they're disrupting others around them, and that's exciting. And then somewhere along the line, it's different for every company, but somewhere along the line, the company says, okay, we're the masters of our, maybe of our local industry, or maybe our industry globally, and now it's time to kind of shift into a routine, business as usual, which is just mind-numbing for any employee and for any leader. You know, executives are employees also. You know, that's something that we don't really think about too much, but they are. And they can get disgruntled or bored as well. And then, you know, thinking in terms of defense, how do we keep, you know, other companies from eating into our market share? Ouch. Ouch, that's horrible. So I know a whole bunch of enterprises. I study, I've got kind of 2 feet planted right now. 1 foot is in startups, especially tech startups, which absolutely fascinate me. And the other is in the enterprise. And what I've learned about the enterprise from just, you know, being involved in it for so long is that very, very large companies, you know, over $1 billion, these companies are kind of more like a government, you know, agency than they are like a business. And they kind of drum out entrepreneurialism. So, you know, you talk about the intrapreneur. It's tough. It's really, really frustrating. I have a friend who, when his boss wanted to hire him for the company that the boss had, so his previous boss at another company wanted to hire him at the boss's new company. And he said, okay, I have a requisition to, you know, for headcount on my team. This is my first choice and my only choice. Let's go. And it still took, even though they had this relationship and, you know, everything else, it still took 8 months for the guy to actually come on board. And the my friend, by the way, was just, you know, eager to go. That's how a bureaucracy works. You expect this kind of thing with, like, the, you know, the State Department of Motor Vehicles. You don't expect it with a business.
So what can a company do in that situation to turn things around?
Think about a business as like in biology, you know, you study how cells grow. Take a bone, for instance. A bone is constantly breaking itself down and building itself up. So it's got both of these in equal measure once it's, you know, fully adult, breaking down and building up. What a bureaucracy does is it builds itself up. A bureaucracy makes more bureaucracy and more processes to be more efficient, but really to be slower. And so what you have is a lot of the building and not a lot of the breaking back down. And, you know, by the way, that's how cancer works. Cancer is just the on switch always on, builds more and more and more of these cells without killing any of them. Well, think of a business the same exact way. So if you've got people whose job it is to make more efficient processes, and you don't have people whose job it is to look at all across the board, all of the processes and say, you know, do we really need that? Is that slowing things down? You know, that's a problem. That's a recipe for disaster. You know, a lot of entrepreneurs run their businesses. They say, oh boy, you know, things are getting too big and unwieldy. We can't have this. And they fix it. Well, when you're a very large company, maybe there's nobody to fix it because the company is too large. The bureaucracy has a life of its own. And whenever that happens, whenever the employees say, you know, we're just too slow, we can't do that. Whenever the conversation is, oh, well, you know, I'd like to do this, but we have to check with this other department. Boy, your company's already in big trouble. You need outsiders to come in with fresh eyes and poke holes and question. And often it takes, you know, a consultant with, you know, if we don't pay him $1 million just to come visit us, then never mind. We're not going to respect this person. But you can hire somebody like that. You can just hire some fresh eyes and say your job is to be our internal consultants. And anytime there's, you know, you see something that doesn't seem right to you, ask why.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. It's a great example. Ted, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you're working on now that's really getting you excited.
Well, my book, A World Gone Social, How Companies Must Adapt to Survive, is, you know, it's kind of, it's 15 different chapters on different aspects of leadership in this new age of business. And my personal focus has always been on top leadership and what are they doing and what can they do to change things. So recently, I'll tell you what sparked this is finally an article I read this weekend. The CEO of Lenovo said, okay, all of our executives will be on social within a week. He said this a couple of days ago. Within a week. He didn't say they should think about it. He didn't say we'll be doing that in a couple of years, which I've heard a lot of CEOs say. The CEO of Lenovo said, okay, 1 week, done. And you'll be on social. You'll be socially active. You are a leader of this company. Lead. I love that. So that really got me thinking over the weekend. And so just grains of research are coming together. So I'm working on the outline of a book. It'll probably take me about 2 years to thoroughly research and write, which the working title is The Modern CEO. And that will be on what does it take to lead an organization in this new age of business. Now that the industrial age is completely behind us, what does that even look like to be a leader? So I'm quite excited about this. I've got a long list already of leaders that I'm going to interview. And it goes far beyond social media, far beyond.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm really looking forward to seeing the result. Ted, who do you know personally who's doing remarkable work?
Well, let me tell you somebody who I'm really lucky to have met with her first book is Dori Clark. So she wrote Reinventing You. And then she just has a brand new book out. I believe that it's available now, although April 28th sticks in my head. Her new book is called Stand Out. So Reinventing You is kind of, all right, you want to have a complete brand redo, maybe start a new career. How do you do that? And it's a really, really good book. It's a quick read. And then Stand Out is, all right, you've determined a new direction you want to go. Now, how do you rise above the fray to really get recognized as, you know, an expert? And even if you're going to stay within a company, by the way, you still need to be recognized within a company as an expert, within that company by your boss, by people above your boss, by your peers. So this is even good if you don't want to change your career into a new direction. Stand Out is a book. I read it in 2 days. It's awesome. I got an advanced copy. And I'm fortunate enough to have met Dori first. I interviewed her maybe a year ago, and then I saw her speak and spend some time with her at the Business Innovation Factory. It's BIF. It's a sister event of TED. And she's just the real deal. I absolutely admire her and enjoy her also.
Yeah, no, Dori is doing cutting-edge work, and I'm pleased that I had her on as a guest on Smashing the Plateau, episode 51, with Eric Rubin. We had two people on together.
Oh, that's the first episode of yours that I listened to, and I absolutely loved it.
Oh, Dori's great.
She won that debate, by the way, in my opinion.
Ted, can you tell listeners how they can learn more about you?
Yeah, I'm always on Twitter, so my name is just at TedCoinA. It's C-O-I-N-E. And then my new blog, which I'm really, really excited about because we have some top talent writing for it, as well as just me, is called openfor.business, the whole word business. So open for business, open and then F-O-R, no tricks here. Openfor.business is advice for enterprise leaders, top leaders in an organization. And I'm really excited about that. So you can see me there, you know, all the time, and you can get to know our other contributors as well.
Great. We'll put that in the show notes. Ted, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Smashing the Plateau. My guest today has been Ted Coyne, Chief Marketing Officer of Metalit. Thank you again, Ted, for joining us.
Thank you, David. It's been a real pleasure.
You've been listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by 10 Strategic Partners. Be sure to visit our website at smashingtheplateau.com and join our email list to hear many more great interviews like this one. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes by going to smashingtheplateau.com/iTunes. I'm your host, David Schreiner-Kahn, and we'll be talking again soon.